Welcome to the Mandela Rhodes Foundation podcast. Under the auspices of our founding patron, Nelson Mandela's dream to build exceptional leadership capacity in Africa, we invite listeners to journey together with us as they hear intimate, behind-the-scenes stories that helped shape the journeys of remarkable African leaders and people on the rise. The Mandela Rhodes Foundation podcast is a platform for authentic and personal narratives of what it truly takes to rise to leadership with a uniquely African lens across a range of topics.
Welcome, Dr. Sangudele. I'm so excited to be in conversation with you. I've really been looking forward to this. How are you coming into this conversation?
I feel great. You know, I feel great. The last couple of weeks were extremely busy with a lot of travel, but the last several days I took some time to rest. And so I feel refreshed, rejuvenated, and ready to have wonderful conversations with my very dear friend.
So maybe perhaps to kick us off, let's go to the beginning. You know, I'm looking back at your upbringing in Ghana, and I'm sort of struck by an interview that you did with Harvard Law Today, where you spoke about how political freedom is meaningless without economic freedom. So when did this reflection first become real for you, thinking about when you were growing up in Ghana?
Yeah, so I think that their reflection culminated over a period of time, right? So there were a number of things I observed. Yes, we were free, politically speaking, right? We were independent. But it was very clear to me that economically we were not free, right? We were not even in control of our own resources, right? If you look at all the amazing resources that we're naturally endowed with, the benefits we get out of that as a country was minuscule compared to what others get, right? In the extractive industries, especially. I also realized that we're part of a global economic system in which we're just not takers, right? We're basically at the mercy of this system in which, you know, let me give a clear example of cocoa. Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire together represent 60-70% of the global cocoa supply. Yet we don't control the price. Right. There are all these different things that showed clear signs and clear evidence that we were not and we are not in charge of our economic future, our economic situation. We're subject to a lot of things outside of our control. And if I remove it from the abstract state level and I even bring it to an individual level, we see the same thing with human beings and individuals, that true freedom in our current global capitalist world, as it is, you can't really be free if you don't have the economic means, right? Because your daily choices and your actions will constantly be constrained by the economic realities of your idiosyncratic situation.
Very much so.
You know, and I think the same applies to society, the same applies to the nation state. The upending to the global order that we're confronted with by Trump alone, for me, is a defining moment and an inflection point for us on the continent. I see it as an opportunity. You know, when USAID was shuttered, it was cruel in the way in which it was done. It was very cruel. And it resulted and has caused adverse impacts for millions and millions and millions of people. But for me, the silver lining there is it's a wake-up call. that as a continent, we cannot continue to rely on others, right, for us to be able to take care of our own people, right? And there's something about our own sovereign dignity and being able to ensure that we are taking care of our own, right? We are working together, because part of the problem we face as a continent, you look at the Europeans, right? With the European Union, the EU that they created. I mean, there's greater differences among them, but they were able to say that, look, this is a way for us to actually gain mutual benefits. Yet, in our continent, we've not been fighting each other for any 100-year wars, right? There's so much more that unites us than divides us. Yet we have been very slow to unite in ways that are very alien to what the independence, freedom fighters and our liberators envisioned.
If you're saying there is then this opportunity for genuine collaboration and connection as Africans so that we can actually stand up and have the African sovereignty voice on a global stage, what are the kind of leadership skills required from Africans to make that happen?
After the American Revolution, George Washington, after the successful overthrow of the British, George Washington became the first president of the new United States. Why do I raise this? I raise this because George Washington made an incredible decision, a prescient one, in which he said, I'm going to step down and go and retire on my farm. And by doing so, he sacrificed his own personal ambitions. I mean, who wouldn't want to be president for life? But he said, I'm not going to do that in the interest of this young fledgling democracy.
Mm-hmm. Which Mandela did, by the way. He did the exact same thing. Same thing.
Look, Mandela would have won, even in a wheelchair crooked, he would have won. We would have all voted for him. From all the other African countries, we would have come and said, we're all voting. Right? And yet, Madiba did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it is that sort of humility and foresight that we need from African leaders to say, look, I am going to give up some sovereignty. I'm going to give up some power. I'm going to give up some control. I'm going to give up all of this for a greater good. And, you know, in some ways, it actually reminds me of scripture and faith, right? In that, you know, as a Christian and a person of faith, Christian doctrine dictates that for you to fully achieve the sort of spiritual enlightenment and to fully experience the highest levels of grace from God, you need to completely empty yourself out. You need to completely subject yourself to him, right? It's a very difficult thing to go. You have to let go, completely let go and let God. But without doing that, you know, so it's a similar thing here.
Yeah.
Until we let go of our pride and ego and realize that, as Kwame Nkrumah said in 1963, that the forces that unite us are intrinsic and greater than the superimposed influences that keep us apart. And Nkrumah also said that Ghana's independence, that the independence, Ghana being the first black nation in sub-Saharan Africa to gain independence, he said the independence of Ghana is meaningless unless it is linked with the total liberation of the African continent. And I will say in today that the political independence of Africa is meaningless without the economic liberation of its states and citizens.
Mm. Very, very powerful. So I like where you're taking us, because you spoke about some of those leadership qualities required around surrender, letting go of ego. And for one to do that meaningfully, it means that you actually are spending significant time self-reflecting on where are my strengths and where are my areas of development. And I'm really struck by how in your TED talk, you spoke about mental health, and that was very powerful, especially, you know, in terms of how you as a leader who's out there, who's doing important work, making changes. But you shared openly about your experience with depression. So what gave you the courage to speak so vulnerably about that kind of topic, especially being an African man and, you know, being raised, men must be strong. You go out and achieve, and you go out and build, and you go out and create. Tell us a bit more about that journey.
You know, like Okonkwo and Things Fall Apart, African men, we are conditioned and raised to not express or process emotions. You're a strong man. You deal with your problems, right? And it is one of the most dangerous, most toxic, and most destructive elements of our social cultural mores. I suffered as a result of that because I was trapped in this jail of toxic masculinity, which, and I found that weakness, where if you express your emotions and if, you know, as a man, it's considered weakness, is actually real strength. Vulnerability is strength. And I had to come out and share it because my experience damn nearly killed me. And I suffered in silence, and I said, I need to make sure that I use my voice so that others do not continue to suffer in silence.
Very powerful.
Because we have to speak against this, because it is killing us. It is killing families. It's affecting and not allowing men to be good partners, good husbands, good leaders, good fathers. Because to experience emotions doesn't make you weak. It makes you human.
That's it.
And denying yourself that is to deny yourself the fullness of your humanity. Even Jesus wept.
Exactly. So I'm then quite interested in hearing how your journey with depression has affected how you lead.
You know, one is it's made me unapologetic about bringing my full self to the office and recognizing that to be your full authentic self means that you have to bring every part of you, and that includes your emotional self. It's also made me acknowledge that people cannot be at their best if they are not in good physical health, mental health, emotional health, spiritual health. And tying back to our earlier conversation on economic freedom, financial health, right? You have someone who's feeling physically sick, who's depressed, who is heartbroken, who is broke. You know, you're not going to get the best out of them. That's just the reality. And so for me as a leader, it means that understanding that means you have to ensure that you're taking care of your people or creating opportunities for people to be cared for across these broader pillars, right? And it means that you're attuned to these issues. You're creating the right conducive environment for people to thrive. You're caring about their well-being, and you're recognizing that the more you invest in the well-being of your people, the greater you will get out of them.
So Sangu, let's talk about a little bit more around sort of innovation in healthcare, you know, and the space that you're operating in. You've had experience both as an entrepreneur and an investor, building ventures and backing other African founders. So from this perspective, what do you think are the essential ingredients of building solutions for Africa by Africa that are both scalable but grounded in the strengths that we bring as a continent?
You know, I've always maintained that brilliance is evenly distributed. It's opportunity that is not. There's no question that across the African continent, the brilliance is there. The issue is how we're able to ensure that that brilliance has an outlet into something productive. And we create a conducive environment so that our brilliance does not leave the shores of our continent. The second thing I'll say is, when it comes to problem solving on our continent, I think one of the big issues I see is this tendency to adopt hook, line, and sinker solutions or models from outside Africa and just impose it on the continent. And I think that's a mistake. If you look at some of the great economic stories and miracles of the last century, if you look at China, which, by the way, has lifted more people out of poverty than all international development programs throughout history combined. Japan, Vietnam. I mean, you can go down the road and you realize, even Germany, you realize that they did things adapted to their local realities. And they figured out what worked for themselves and came up with solutions that work for themselves. And so you go and you see that the Japanese economy is set up differently from the Chinese economy, how the Germans, they went with what worked for themselves. And it for me, part of that is because they had a clear vision. They had a very clear vision about where they wanted to go and an alignment at a national level of how to get there. See the same thing with Singapore, which is another incredible story. I think part of the problem we have is a lack of vision, a lack of alignment. You know, the African Union makes me sad because it has so much potential, but remains a dream perpetually deferred. We need to put our money where our mouth is. We have all this talk and we know the potential of our unity. We see it in the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement, 1.4, 1.5 billion people, $3 to $4 trillion economy. Yet, look at our contributions to the African Union. The African Union's budget is like $600 million. The EU's budget is $180 billion. The African Union is dependent on donors for some of its budgets. Its headquarters was constructed by the Chinese. Think about that for a second and what that means for our sovereign dignity as people. And so we as Africans need to be able to show that we are committed to African unity in deeds and not just in words. We need to put money where our mouth is. We need to invest in the institution that would allow us to achieve the sort of union we spew so much beautiful rhetoric about, but do very little to institutionalize in a real way.
Yeah.
We have demographic power, right? That there's this big debate. Is this going to be a demographic disaster, a demographic dividend? 1 in 4 people will be African in the next 25 years. 40% of the planet will be African by the end of the century. We have a digital infrastructure today that's uniting Africans faster than any sort of union could. we're becoming more and more integrated from a digital perspective and foregoing borders when it comes to the digital economy. Africa holds 40% of global reserves of critical minerals. 40%. I mean, we literally could create like a green OPEC for minerals, for energy transition. And with all the things that are happening today with the US, EU, China, we could play a critical role in global power realignment if we get our acts together. And we are not getting our acts together because we continue to focus on individual states. We continue to be fragmented in our thinking, fragmented in our actions. And that lack of a unified response consistently makes us second-class citizens on the global stage.
Yeah, I think you said it. And so I'm curious about, if we zone back to you leading CarePoint and in a sense trying to do some of the things you're speaking about systemically, because you blend clinical facilities with digital platforms to expand access to healthcare. So what are some of the maybe one or two key lessons that you've learned about innovating in Africa, working at a systems level, and creating that mutually agreed alignment that allows everyone to see, if we do this, this can really help shift systems in Africa?
It's a great question. You know, healthcare is one of the biggest challenges we face, and it is one of the core pillars for Africa's development. We cannot reach our greatest aspirations if we don't have a healthy population, if we don't have an educated population, and if we do not have a healthy, educated population with economic opportunities. So health is one of the key pillars. I always say you can build all the schools and all the infrastructure and all of that, if your people are not healthy, it's cost 90. So it starts with health. On our continent, what does our health situation look like? We're 16, 17% of global population, yet we represent 25% of the global disease burden. And we only have 3% of global healthcare workers. In fact, over 50% of Africans do not have access to modern healthcare. That is the context in which we operate. And so we have had to, you know, innovation for us is not a luxury. It's not a cool, sexy thing. It is the only way we're going to be able to resolve these structural imbalances and these supply-demand constraints that prevent over half of our people getting access to decent, dignified care. We realized in our experiment in leveraging digital technologies to expand access that we need to do things on the basis of our local realities. And let me give you a clear example. When we first started looking at telemedicine on paper, fantastic. It democratizes access. It sounds amazing. But what we realized from our example is that telemedicine is mostly done on smartphones. And so who has smartphones on the continent? Generally, those at the higher socioeconomic level. So telemedicine in a bizarre way actually ends up reproducing and amplifying those very structural inequalities it is purported to fix. So we had to rethink the model. And so we then came up with a different model. And we said, in some of the rural locations, the challenge is not going to the facility. The challenge is really having doctors. Then even if you were to give, let's say we got into a deal with one of the phone manufacturers and they said, we're going to donate free smartphones to every African who doesn't have it. Let's say you have a situation like that. Still not solve the problem. You know why? Cost of data in Africa is among the highest in the world. So what do? We went to these clinics and we said, how about we bring telemedicine here So inside the clinic, in the doctor's office, we set up a virtual doctor's office.
Mm-hmm.
Because there we can provide the broadband internet connection. And so that is a twist, right, on the typical teleconsultation model to say that, no, you come in, we have a nurse, and when the nurse checks you, we have digital diagnostic kits, those sorts of things, and then we take you to see the doctor, you walk in, and there's a screen. Now, that, to me, is the sort of innovation we need to do to be able to solve the problem of access. We need to look and see what is going to work for our market, and we need to look at it from a perspective of understanding what are the real issues and challenges. Because oftentimes we don't properly understand the problems and the challenges because the very beneficiaries of our so-called solutions are not in the room when those solutions are being designed. And so the people making assumptions about the problems are people who don't experience those problems. You can't have the rich designing problems for the poor.
Exactly. So it's sort of interesting point that you're raising that I'm curious about is the cultural sort of normalization process required when you are now solving for that issue, right? So they don't have the smartphones, they don't have the data. But now, where is the doctor? Oh, you are bringing a machine. I'm talking to a machine, right? So there's still an education component, the cultural norming component. How have you sort of navigated around that?
It's a very good question, but that's why you take a hybrid approach, because there's a nurse. So it's not like there's zero human being. In fact, I'll tell you that we had a conversation with a company in Asia where at first the idea was to kind of put these tech-enabled microclinics that don't have any human being in it, right? You go in, you sit in this chair, test all your things, and we had lots of discussions with them, and I said, our people will run away. Like, you're going to tell them to go into this random machine, there's no human being, and to sit inside something that covers, I mean, no. But here, it's a bit different because you actually do have a human being, right, who's a part of the process. But at the end of the day, it's different if there's already access and you are trying to present new tech options. We're dealing with a situation where over 50% of Africans don't have access to modern care. So what's the alternative? Our example has shown that people will be adoptive of things that will be able to improve their care, especially in their context where there are no other options.
And so thinking about problems that we face as Africa, as you speak to, that are quite unique, but also global, something that I've been listening to over the sort of past while is the lack of venture capital preparedness that Africa has compared to the West, right? So now you're going to Silicon Valley or you're going to Asia and you're pitching, here's a new innovation that will really change the lives of Africans. But they look at that problem and they go, this doesn't sound like anything big and new, because to your point, you're saying we have some sort of first industrial revolution challenges on the continent. So how do you square up this reality of where Africans are technologically, given the systemic realities, versus the ability to attract venture capital to actually invest and believe that if they contribute to some of these social problems, they might still be able to get a return on investment?
Look, the thing with venture capital, I remember when I started Golden Palm Investments some 19 years ago, the entire venture ecosystem on the continent was probably about $20 million. It peaked $5 billion a couple of years ago. While that was fantastic news and we celebrated, the harsh reality is that only 20% of the venture flows in Africa come from Africa. Only 20%. And that's why anytime you see, you know, macro instability or any of these sorts of issues, you suddenly see a pullback, capital flight. That's why you saw venture flows drop by over 50% year over year. And if you look at how venture ecosystems have been built elsewhere, in the US and Israel and other places, they were funded by long-term capital, pension funds. What are our pension funds on the continent doing? We have over $1 trillion of assets. What are we doing? Why are we not investing in creating fund managers that will help fund our venture ecosystem? It goes back to that issue I brought around the AU, right? He who pays the piper sets the tune. And if we are not investing in our own venture ecosystem, how is that venture ecosystem going to be responsive to our priorities and challenges? They will be responsive to the priorities of who is funded. Mm-hmm. And so and all these, even though a lot of what we've been talking about is very different conversations, health, venture, politics, they all somehow tie back to this idea of sovereign dignity.
I think I love how we've danced around the personal, the interpersonal, the global, and the different dynamics. Because a lot of our listeners are really trying to gain some wisdom about the formative years that shape who we are and what we're talking about. I love the story that you told about your mother teaching you at, I think you're about 5 years old, to look into the mirror each night and ask yourself, what did I achieve today? So in the midst of running these impressive companies, serving on prestigious boards, and, you know, engaging on so many global platforms, do you still hold yourself accountable to the daily sense of purpose and making each day count?
I do, you know, and I've actually amended that exercise my mother made me do. What have you accomplished today? And I've added to that, how have you impacted someone today? Because accomplishments don't always necessarily cause external impact. I could achieve a lot of money today for myself, but how has that created a positive impact on someone else? So those are the two things that I question myself on every day. And I still do that reflection. And I'll tell you, it's not every day I like my responses. But the takeaway for me is we rise and do better tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. How do you think about rest in the context of the busy lives that you lead and the multiple demands? You're a father, you are a board member, you're a chairperson, you're a CEO, you're a friend. And I've experienced you as someone who's quite intentional about making sure that you really are connected and show up for those that you care about.
So to me, rest is critical. I think of rest in a number of key ways. So the first is, it's spiritual. God, our creator, commanded rest. Genesis 2:2 tells us, by the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested. So the Sabbath was instituted not just for worship, but for liberation. The Sabbath, to me, is a weekly reminder that we are more than our labor. And so when we rest, we imitate God's balance, which is creating and then delighting in the creation. And you can't delight in the creation at the same time you are creating. So you need time to delight in the creation.
Let's go.
So that's one to me is a spiritual. The second to me is rest is resistance. Because in our world that glorifies the hustle. And you know me, I'm a hustler. But we over-glorify the hustle and the struggle. Rest to me is a quiet and important and underrated and understated act of rebellion. It says, I am not a machine and my worth will not be only measured by output. Because rest really challenges the capitalist logic.
Very much.
That your value is a function of your productivity.
Mm.
And let's not forget that that was the same logic that once justified the exploitation of human bodies and now sanctifies burnout. So to me, to rest, especially as Africans, is to reclaim our humanity in a system that often demands superhuman endurance.
Mm-hmm. I love it. I love it. And I resonate with that because as the superheroes that we sort of were built to become, right? We are this generation that is coming out with good educational outcomes. You and me have had the privilege of studying at Ivy League universities in the US, sitting on global platforms. And all of that has some privileges, but it's also a lot of responsibility around, but when am I having a moment to breathe, you know? And I think I burnt out a few years ago, and it really taught me that humility, as you say, to actually say to myself, but you know, when I rest and then I actually do my hike the next day, do you know how much more effective I am in the work? I can actually do less hours, but be more effective if I rest more. But it's a mental model and a shift in the mindset of, everyone's glorified. Hey, how are you doing? Ah, you know, I'm so busy. 16-hour days. Ah, you know, I'm not sleeping. And everyone goes, yeah, brah, me too. It becomes this competition about who's not sleeping versus how might it be if we are meeting up for a lunch or a hike to say, how are you doing? And to say, I'm so well rested. I had 8 hours of sleep. I did yoga this morning. You know, you start off a meeting like that, they're going to look at you and say, ah, this one, are you even doing anything at work? Because what is all this rest? But actually, if you look at the productivity outcomes, there are way more for people who spend targeted time refueling as well as then sort of focusing in. So I love that you're there because it's the same thing that I'm thinking about, you know? So as we wrap up, Sangu, last question for you because you've been so generous with your time. If you can leave our listeners with one key message or principle that they can maybe carry on in their leadership journeys, what would that be from you?
All you have is today. What are you going to do with it? And how are you going to make sure that the 24 hours you have today are going to have impact, but are also going to have rest? So you can delight in your creation.
Thank you for listening to the Mandela Rhodes Foundation podcast. To learn more about the Mandela Rhodes Foundation, visit our website at www.mandelarhodes.org. Follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram for more updates. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast on your platform of choice to be notified of new episodes. This is a Volume Podcast production.